Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we did. We started to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams of Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song, the Grammy-winning Solartopia song from Tomorrow's Children album on Appleseed Records. This is Harvey Wasserman. We're back for another hour in Solartopia. I got a good show with two great guests from Southern California to talk about the San Onofre nuclear plant, which we've successfully shut down, and the question of nuclear waste and who's going to pay for it in Southern California is a big deal because so many nuclear plants are going to be shutting in the near future. Not near enough for me, but hopefully more and more, quicker and quicker. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to be joined by Mark Ash, the publisher of the wonderful reader-supported news website, where A Piece of Mind will be published shortly. And I want to talk to Mark about there's so many websites out there, and the ins and outs and trials and tribulations of running a website for a progressive audience. But first, we're going to talk about nuclear waste. I know the EcoWatch will be writing a major piece by Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear this within the next day or two, which I will link to. Kevin has been a longtime campaigner dealing with nuclear waste in the Great Lakes. But we have two great experts from Southern California, and that'll be at EcoWatch.com, by the way. From Southern California, you have Donna Gilmore and Ace Hoffman. Are you both with us?
Hi, I'm here, Ace.
I'm here.
Oh, good. Good for you. Reporting on time and in order. So you are two of the toughest activists I've ever met, and we have a truly great victory to continue to celebrate. I celebrate it every day, the shutdown of the San Onofre nuke, the two reactors there, and the third one has been shut for a long time. But this shutdown of San Onofre was a huge victory for grassroots activism and citizens going out and making a better world. But there are some serious issues that continue to plague us and a lot of money being fought over. Donna, can you describe for us, Donna Gilmore, the situation with nuclear waste now at San Onofre and what the fight is all about?
Well, we have multiple fights. The one I'm focused on right now, a number of us are focused on, is the dry storage canisters. Unbeknownst to even a lot of activists, they've switched from thick up to 14 to 10 to 20 inch thick metal containers. They've switched to half inch thick containers. That's what they have.
All right, let's stop right there, Donna. Donna, let's stop right there. They switched. Let's put this in perspective. They switched from 20-inch thick containers to half-inch thick containers?
Well, in the United States, they were using 10 to 14-inch containers. In Germany, they use containers that are about 20 inches thick. So, yeah, but in the United States, they initially started using thick metal containers that were 10 to 14 inches thick, and they switched to half-inch thick. San Onofre decided to use an extra eighth of an inch thick one, yeah.
My God, and I mean, that's insane. And we're talking about
and
the containers
want,
that hold.
They want to buy more, and that's one of the things I'm fighting. We've had, at San Onofre, they started loading these containers, they're called canisters, these thing canisters. They started loading the spent fuel from the reactor in 2003. And the NRC has information that indicates that, you know, we could have a leak in another 7 years, and no one's dealing with this. Edison's not dealing with it. The one that manages the plant, Southern California Edison. I have a video of the NRC director of spent fuel telling the Coastal Commission that they can't even inspect these canisters now. He says it's not a now thing. So they don't know if these containers have started to crack. But what they do know, and they put in writing, is that once a crack starts, it will take 16 years, and it'll go all the way through the container. And then I asked the director, I said, well, what happens if it cracks all the way through? I said, I've read reports that with the pools that most of the fuel is currently in, the fuel, after it comes out of the reactor, it has to cool for a number of years underwater, and then they move it to these dry storage canisters. I said, I read that if any air gets to that spent fuel, you can have an explosion. I said, could the same thing happen if air gets in these canisters? And he said, well, there's really nobody here qualified to answer that question. And this is the NRC that approved these containers.
Now, these containers are holding spent fuel rods that are the most lethal, most toxic, most radioactive substances ever created. Is that correct?
Yes. Each one of these containers, because, you know, they've been running this reactor for years and years and years, and so that all that waste, that wasted fuel, which is extremely highly radioactive and not really very stable, I mean, each container is so huge that you've got about as much radium, about radiation, about as much cesium-137, for example, as was released from Chernobyl. Okay, we don't know exactly how far a leak or an explosion is going to spread all that, but I mean, if one container, they've got 51 containers there, and they have a few of these at Diablo Canyon. They've been installed longer at San Onofre. But, you know, just one of these 51 containers, you know, we just need one to leak to really change the whole view of Southern California. I mean, I'm at the point that I will sell my, if Edison gets away with ignoring this problem and buying more of these inferior containers, I will sell my house. I would not want to own real estate knowing this ticking time bomb was sitting there and nobody's dealing with it.
So, Ace Hoffman, you work with Donna on this, so what do you got to say?
Well, she's right, and it actually just keeps getting worse. We were attending a Department of Energy meeting yesterday online, and they firmly believe that these canisters do not need to be inspected, that you can close them once and leave them closed until you've taken them away to an interim storage site, which I hope we'll talk about soon, and then to a permanent repository without ever opening them or looking at them. And a crack can form from the inside out or from the outside in. So to have no inspections is ridiculous, and to let them just sit for, you know, 20 years or 40 or 300 years is even more ridiculous. But that's their plan.
You know, it's just staggering to me. You know, this stuff is so lethal. These spent fuel rods, which are in arrays, right? How many spent fuel rods are in each rack that they put into these canisters?
They call it a basket. There's 24. They call fuel assemblies. I don't know how many rods are in each fuel assembly. I don't know if you know that, Ace, or not. But the current ones hold 24 fuel assemblies, and then the new ones Edison wants to buy, they're going to hold 37 of them. But maybe Ace, you have some sense of the size of this better than I do.
There's maybe a couple, maybe 12 dozen, 144 or so fuel rods in each assembly.
And how big are these dry casks?
As big as a school bus, almost.
Oh, God. So we're talking, what, 20, 30 feet by 10 or 15 feet? Is that right?
Yeah, and they, by about 10 or 12 feet, I think.
And they're standing upright?
They will be. The new ones are supposed to. Right now, they're building horizontally stored dry cask units.
And are they off, they lifted off the ground, or they just sit on the ground?
They're on a the current ones are on a cement pedestal, basically, and then they're surrounded by more cement to keep the gamma rays from harming the the workers that walk by it. So there's 3 to 5 feet of cement around each one.
But the concrete has air vents in it to let the hot air out, so it's not sealed.
Huge air vents.
Yeah.
God, I mean, this is like apocalyptic stuff. Now, I assume that these things are vulnerable to attack.
Of course.
Well, I think Mother Nature is going to be your biggest attacker. We've got them by the ocean. The NRC has admitted that salt air is one of the most corrosive things you can have with the stainless steel. And there's a nuclear plant in South Africa that's situated similar, where they have onshore winds and fog and surf. And they had a container. It wasn't holding nuclear waste, but the NRC says it's similar in the way it's manufactured and the materials. It leaked in 17 years. And it was over a half inch thick.
God, oh my! It's just a mind. Now, at the fuel that's the spent fuel, so-called spent fuel, that's still at San Onofre. How much is still in the pool, and how much has been moved to the dry cask?
Well, they're going to have about 85 more canisters to fill. So we've got 51 filled. Exactly, 50 have spent fuel, one has some other radioactive stuff, and I got about 85 more they've got to fill. So the bulk of it hasn't been put in canisters yet, and I'm intervening with the Public Utility Commission to try and stop them from giving Edison the money to buy these. And the state has no authority over radiation impact, so your case has to be made based on cost issues. But that's relatively easy to make because Edison assumed that nothing's going to go on with these canisters and they won't have to be replaced. And the contention that I've made is that they will start having to be replaced in, 20 to 30 years. Not that it, if it releases radiation, that's a whole other ballgame. But I had to make a cost argument on that. And so that's what I've done. We're waiting for a decision from the judge. The thick cast technology that's used in most of the rest of the world, they're likely to hold up. I think the longest canister anywhere has been in use about 40 years. The ones at Fukushima were thick metal cast, I'm not sure what the thickness was. It was over 10 inches. And those, what was I going to say about that? I lost my thought on
that. Well, how much, Asa or Donna, what is the cost difference between a cask designed to hold these high-level fuel rods that's 20 inches thick versus one that's 1 inch thick?
We don't know exactly.
Half inch, yeah. Well, it's hard to get current numbers. Edison has refused to tell us how much they're planning to pay for these. They're refusing to give us that information and make it public. But cost information I have from other states is they're running, and based on Edison's estimates, the thin half-inch ones, counting the concrete and the labor, they're about $4 million apiece now. That was for the above ground systems. They aren't telling us how much it's going to cost to put in this underground or below ground system. That's another story. The thick, their Areva thick cast, those are about 10, 11 inches. Those run about, over about $6 million. So they cost more. But the thin ones, you have to start buying a lot of extra things that, doesn't get included in that cost. And the thick ones are likely, the advantage of the thick metal ones is you can inspect them, if there's any corrosion, you can maintain that. You know, you can, and they keep them painted. They have bolted lids with a sensor to know if there's any issues with leaks. If there's a seal, they can replace the seal. So they're maintainable. And because they're so thick, they're going to last a lot. They're going to last a lot longer. So the ones in Europe that are 40 years old, they're really not showing any signs, any significant signs of any degradation. There may have been a couple that had to have one of the metal seals replaced, but that's maintainable, and that's what you want, is something that you can maintain, inspect, maintain, repair, have an early warning before there's a radiation release. None of that applies to what they've been buying in the United States. We've got over almost 2,000 of these inferior canisters installed around the country. That's one of the things we're working to stop, trying to get the right people educated on this.
It's really a national disgrace, Harvey, and the thick canisters survive much stronger tests for fire resistance and impact damage and things like that. Well, there's no reason not to be using them.
Well, except there's, it's not that huge a difference. Are you saying the thin canisters cost $4 million and the thick canisters cost $6
million? You're right. For the ones I have the bids on, the Areva TN, they're called some of TN24 or TN40, that's the model. Fukushima has thick cast. Now, one of the things they discovered after Fukushima, they held up, they didn't have a problem, but they took the lid off of one just to make sure that nothing was going wrong inside. The thin ones, the half-inch ones, they're totally welded shut, so you can't even look inside to see what's going on or if anything's wrong. So they took a lid off of one of the Fukushima ones, and they found that there's this metal basket inside that holds the spent fuel assembly. They've assessed that they were using aluminum, and they're thinking that may only last 40 years. So they know that now. So now they use the material they probably shouldn't have, so now they can deal with that. They can replace that with something. With us, they're using aluminum baskets here in these welded canisters, and we can't even open them to see what's going on. So it gets even worse. It gets even worse. The worse it is. And the Department of Energy, I raised these issues yesterday because they've been directed to develop a pilot design, nothing to implement. They don't have the money, but to come up with a design for a consolidated interim storage site to put on some community that probably doesn't know what's going on. They had their first consent meeting yesterday to say, hey, who's willing to take this? What's the criteria? And I said, well, are you going to have any public meetings on the technical issues? And who's your technical point person? And, what about all these problems? And he referred me to another government agency. That had nothing, from what I see with the DOE, they just listen. They're just doing whatever the vendors recommend. And they even had one of the vendors that make these thin canisters write one of their reports, and that's what they're using and going forward with for a design. I didn't realize how bad the Department of Energy was. It's worse than I thought.
Yeah. Now, Ace, you mentioned that you want to talk about interim storage. You want to raise some issues about that?
Well, yeah, because when San Onofre closed almost four years ago now, we suddenly became just a community with a nuclear waste dump in it. And the attitude of many locals changed pretty significantly, where they might have supported San Onofre, or even if they didn't, and now all their concern is to get rid of the waste and get it out of here. In fact, one of the city councilmen from the city next to the one I live in, Oceanside, has been going around to other cities, including mine, Carlsbad, and trying to get the cities to sign on to a plan to encourage the federal government, the Department of Energy, to institute and implement an interim storage site in order to get the waste away from here. And this all sounds like a great idea, but there are no sites. There's no good sites, and there's no such thing as a community that's going to want this stuff, unless, of course, you pay them enough money, which is hardly an informed consent decision. It's just kind of greed, you know, doing its thing. So right now, because we're a closed site, we're trying to put a lot of pressure to accomplish nothing, because there is no place to put the waste. There's never going to be a safe place. And so what Don is talking about, the thicker casks, is an interim solution on site at the plant, because there are no other solutions. There never will be other solutions.
Well, these are also transportable. So if we do get like an ocean rise at some point in the future, it's a lot easier to move them away, you know, further inland, because the thick ones are already built for storage and transportation.
Well, the thin ones, what would it be like to try to move the thin ones?
Risky.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Risky. Sorry. Is that what you said? Yeah, we're talking with Ace Hoffman and Donna Gilmore from Southern California about the waste, the residual waste at the San Onofre Nuke, which has been shut for a while, two reactors there, and then there was a third one, the first one originally shut quite a while ago. It was a huge victory to shut these reactors, but now we have the realities of dealing with the waste, and it's not a pretty picture. And also, of course, the issue of who pays for all this. Can you talk to us about what's going on with Edison and the public and the Public Utility Commission about who's going to pay for all this stuff?
Well, Edison wants to have the waste moved to an interim site and the ownership of the waste go to the Department of Energy, which, of course, is us, the public, so that they can wash their hands of it, literally. And a lot of people oppose that for a lot of reasons. So at the moment, Edison is stuck owning the waste.
And with
the Public Utility Commission, they want to take all the money that's been saved up to dismantle the plant, and they want to use some of that to pay for the nuclear waste storage here. But then they've left no money. So when these things fail and have to be replaced, they have no money available to do that. And it will cost a lot more to replace than it would be to do it right the first time.
And that's assuming there's no accident.
Right. Now, what is the status? Go ahead.
And the other big thing, we have a lot of people in the community here that have switched from the shutting the plant down support. Now they're only focused on getting it out of here. So we need more people focused on making sure it's stored safely, no matter where it is, because that's the first priority. They're giving people false promises. Edison is really promoting this idea that we could really have this waste go somewhere. There's no funding. That you need legislation passed, and then they have to find the billions and billions of dollars to fund it, and then find a willing community, and then you have all your lawsuits. I mean, Yucca Mountain has over 200 legal contentions pending, plus technical issues. So there are so many roadblocks. It's just a wishful thinking that they're going to be able to get this waste out of here anytime in the next few decades. They've been trying for 50 years to find a place to put it, permanent and temporary, and every effort has failed. So that's
and what's happening. What's happening with the actual dismantlement of the plant? Has there been any progress in dismantling these two reactors?
They're waiting to get their hands the Public Utility Commission decommissioning proceeding to give them the money and to approve their plans for how to tear it down. We're waiting for a decision from the judge. All the parties made our case about what they should do, and we're waiting for a decision. Now I do have kind of late breaking news that the Energy Department of the PUC has used some kind of advice letter process to agree to give them millions of dollars to start the process, the decommissioning process, quite a few millions of dollars. They they weren't supposed to do that until after the judge made a decision on this. So I have an attorney I'm working with that's filing an appeal to that. But, you know, the PUC, you know, is a tough one to win with. And it doesn't help if the governor and his administration believe these utility companies when they say everything is fine and safe, you know. So that's a big problem. I really think if we could get the Brown administration educated on the facts, that maybe it would help. But that's been a challenge.
Well, the Brown administration
admitted that cannabis factories, they even admitted it, but yet they voted to give Edison a permit to put in more of these inferior canisters. So, you know, that's a whole other show. But but we're doing what we can to stop this. And I'm not quitting, period. You know, I don't care if they start digging a hole for these things. I'm not stopping on this because, you know, this is critical. And I'm working with other states on this issue, and we've got a, you know, we're growing nationally and informing people on this. So we could use a material engineer. If somebody has a material engineer that's willing to speak truth, that would be very helpful to us. So I'll put that out there.
Well, California's about to get a new governor, right? The election is this fall. Or is it 28?
I think Newsom is running for governor, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah, now, you have a good one. Jerry Brown is almost done, is that right?
Yes.
So, hopefully, the new governor will be maybe a little more conscientious, but if there's no money in the decommissioning fund, who's going to pay for these casks?
Well, I think this decision is going to be made before we have a new governor. It'll all be, you know, it'll be too late for that. We may be able to stop them from buying more at Diablo Canyon, because Diablo Canyon is also using 10 canisters. So, and I know you wanted to talk about the state land issue.
Well, real quickly, yes. We only have till the half hour at this point. I could talk to you guys for hours about
this. Okay, the State Lands Commission is an independent agency. The state controller, the lieutenant governor, and a representative from the governor's office—the three of them—and they are extremely independent from the governor. So, if any agency will make a decision different than the governor, this would be one of them. I used to work for a number of state controllers, so I'm very familiar with how often they would have a difference there. So it's possible something could happen with Diablo with Newsom, but I don't know if that will happen. I mean, he has taken quite a bit of money from PG&E contribution-wise. He did raise some concerns about the global warming thing, so maybe it's worth a visit to try and educate him more on this issue. But it is possible for them to do something, and I'll give him a
Ace Hoffman, you want to chime in on that?
Well, Gavin Newsom has been pushing the idea that with all the earthquakes that have been discovered near the Diablo Canyon plant, it may not be safe. I certainly agree with him on that. The only problem is that he's not going to be allowed to make any kind of ruling based on safety, because the NRC will come swooping down and say, that's our job, and you keep away from it. And they've done this many times. They do it in every state that they need to, at every agency that they need to. They literally come in and say, get away from our business. So
they'll find a different approach. The key at the state level is you have to stick where the state has legal authority. So the word radiation has to be totally out of the conversation. The state has absolutely no authority over regulating anything radiological. So it has
or
to be
safety.
Cause for environmental and other issues. That's the key.
Wow. Well, this is life, at least in San Onofre, life after nuclear power. And the issues are staggering. These thin casts, which you say are all over the country now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, everywhere there's a nuclear plant. Yeah, that not most nuclear plants have these.
All right. There's more than 2,000 dry casks around the country.
2,000. But how many will we ultimately need?
For the waste that is already in existence at nuclear power plants, we need over 10,000 dry casks. That's an awful lot of targets, if I may use the term.
Wow. And it's a ton of money, too. Well, you guys, it's just fantastic. You're still on the case, Ace Hoffman, Donna Gilmore. We appreciate it. Well, we'll talk again soon about continuing issues with taking down, thankfully, the San Onofre plant. But it's a sobering conversation to have after the fantastic victory of shutting down San Onofre, which we have yet to win at Diablo Canyon. The issue continues to rage and to threaten us all. What's the website people should get to?
What's the what?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
To SanOnofreSafety.org.
SanOnofreSafety.org.
All right. Thank you both, Donna Gilmore and Ace Hoffman. We'll be back to you again. We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk to Mark Ash from Reader Supported News. Thank you guys so much for being with us.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thanks, Harvey.
Bye.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia?
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Gary Null's incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial issues have won dozens of international awards. As a free service to listeners, acclaimed films such as War on Health and Seeds of Death are available to watch in their entirety online. Just go to YouTube and search for Gary Null. Thank you for your continued support.
Hi, this is Tony Hendra.
And Jeff Chrysler.
Of the Final Edition Radio Hour.
On PRN.
Your source for organic,
gluten-free,
sustainable
satire.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on a garden.
All right, we are back after a short break. A devastating conversation on the nuclear waste situation at the San Onofre reactors. And, of course, this is going on all over the country. I'm not actually sure. I should find out how many reactors have been shut down in this country. I think it's a couple dozen already. And, it's just the nuclear power just keeps on threatening the human race. This question of whether we're going to have these thin, cranky little tin can canisters for this radioactive waste or for the, or we're going to have the more expensive but far more safe and secure, thick radioactive waste containers, generally called dry casks, is astounding that Edison and the other utilities, of course, want to get away with the cheaper ones, even though the health of the public and the environment is totally put at risk. And this is an issue, of course, we've shut Vermont Yankee, Fitzgerald, Fitzpatrick in upstate New York, is going to be shutting Crystal River in Florida. These reactors have shut recently. And everywhere we have these huge quantities of incredibly deadly radioactive waste sitting around. And, of course, the owners of the reactors who profited all these years while risking the health of the public now want to walk away and leave this garbage, this horrific garbage, in our hands. Kevin Camps, as I mentioned, will have an article about this at ecowatch.com in the next day or so. And we'll continue, of course, to follow the issue. We are joined now by Mark Ash. Mark, are you with us?
I am.
Very good. You sound a little distant, so if you could sidle up to your phone, that'd be great. Where are you, Mark?
I am in California. I am on a cell phone with an old-style over-the-head headset and a microphone that normally performs pretty well.
Yeah, you sound all right. You're good. You're good to go. We'll maybe turn up the volume a bit on you. But so we have a half an hour, Mark, and I want to talk to you about the proliferation of websites and how to manage them and what their impact might be. And we can also talk about the article that you are now posting that I wrote with Bob Chytraeus at your own website, Reader Supported News. So
sure.
You, as I understand it, are the founder of Reader Supported News. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Also the founder of Truth App prior to that.
Well, let's talk about that now. What has prompted you to go into the world of founding these websites? What do you have in mind?
Well, what prompted me is the kind of thing that you were discussing with your last guest, and that would be the type of, you know, environmental degradation at the San Onofre. I'm tempted not even to call it a nuclear site. For the people that live there, San Onofre is a stunningly beautiful, still wild part of the Southern California coast, which is rare. Obviously, you don't really get that anymore in Southern California. It's a wildlife preserve and a very beautiful place. And I'm really saddened to hear, you know, that your report in that regard. I know a lot of the people there, and I know a lot of the people that visit and use that area. And I'll tell you, I don't think they're going to back off and stop using it. I think that a lot of people are still going to go there. And they're very committed. That community down there is very, very committed. They love that place. And I think they're going to risk it.
Well, I've never stopped at San Onofre, but I have ridden a train up and down from L.A. to San Diego.
Right.
And you go right by the reactors there.
Right.
And
I've been out there 1,000 times. I know it very, very, very well.
Are you a surfer?
I am.
Oh, you are? You're a surfer. So did you surf at San Onofre when the...
I've surfed outside the reactors 1,000 times. I've surfed all up and down that entire stretch throughout what the locals call trestles. Uppers, lowers, that's where the international surfing contests are held. And I'm going to tell you, they're not likely to back off, no matter what the Geiger counter says.
Well, I was told that the San Onofre run there is one of the best areas in the world for surfing.
Well, it is the one spot there that the surfers call lowers is the premier break in the United States. There's obviously some, you know, there's always debate on that point. But when the international contests are held in the United States, they're held at that spot that it's called lowers. And in September, when they hold those contests, when the waves are just right, it could be a spectacular break with a beautiful wave. Well, it can go anywhere from two. I mean, you could be looking anywhere from a 10-foot drop to a 20-foot drop out there. But it peels so nicely is the thing that makes it so special. And really, when it's right, it just peels along, and the surfers can kind of work the face of the wave, and the great surfers can do miraculous things. It's really wonderful to watch.
Well, good for you. So I did not envision talking with you about surfing, but it's great to know that. I'm sure you are vastly relieved that those reactors are finally shut.
Well, absolutely. I mean, everybody that surfs there thinks about it. But I can tell you, I've attended local community meetings there. The people that wanted them shut down and were prepared. But, I mean, locals don't stop. They do not stop. They go there. This is right below Richard Nixon's old Western White House in the San Clemente Cliffs. It overlooks the area. And there are legendary tales of surfers dodging Marines to get into the water with their surfboards and dodging Secret Service agents with submachine guns to get into the water to surf the waves because the Secret Service didn't want them out there because they were too close to President Nixon's home. And at that time, it was still controlled by the Marine Corps as a part of Camp Pendleton. It wasn't public land. It was ceded to the public by Richard Nixon.
Well, so, I hate nuclear power plants, but the one thing I always liked about San Onofre was that if it went, it was going to take Nixon with it. That was the one.
He's the one that ceded it to public domain, which I thought was something. You know, look, it's easy to hate Richard Nixon.
Wow. So we hear one redeeming quality that Richard Nixon might have had.
Well, so, they all do some good, right?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, you just never know. So, Mark, tell us now, why did you start reader-supported news? Why would you go out into the world of the Internet and start a website and then try to attract readers? What is the motivation, and how did you do it, and what are the current issues with reader-supported news?
It's not really about websites. And I'm really, if you want to know, I'm really not a great website builder. I was a Al Gore volunteer in 2000.
What kind of volunteer?
Al Gore, for the Al Gore campaign.
Oh, Al Gore. Oh, God. I wasn't expecting Al Gore. Okay, so, yeah, you worked for Al Gore, and?
I didn't work for him. I was a volunteer.
Okay.
The whole thing with the meltdown, speaking of meltdowns, with Florida in 2000, and the appointment of George Bush to the presidency, none of this worked for me. I had no patience with that at all. The little bit of volunteer work I did for the Gore campaign, I was building websites at the time, and I worked on their kids page for the campaign, actually for the convention. I had the name at the point Truth Out, and I was, darn it, we have to do something about this. So I got online and I began writing articles. And I began saying to people, we have to do something about this. And people just started flocking to the site. And within 2 to 3 years, we had 20 employees. We had a budget of over $1 million. And we were going gangbusters. And so was the Bush administration. The Bush administration was a unique time. And the Bush administration put so much fear in the hearts of decent, concerned Americans that people, I mean, I think even a lot of Republicans looked at George Bush with quiet trepidation. I mean, they had to know that this guy was really interested, hell-bent, on starting World War III. They had to understand that. They couldn't possibly, any person with a reasonable degree of education could understand that. So that was the driving force.
You built Truth Out out of the Gore campaign.
No, the Gore campaign, this all came about as the Gore campaign. Look, as of December 13th, 2000, the Gore campaign was over. The Supreme Court made their ruling. Lawrence Tribe read the ruling on the steps of the Supreme Court, interpreted it, along with the CNN reporters, and the campaign was over. Truth Out really began about a month later, on the 1st of January 2001. But, you know, it was an outgrowth, of outrage over that decision, what happened in Florida, and of course I know you've done a tremendous amount of work on voting and vote counting, and that's very important. But there was a great deal of outrage at that point, and there were organizing meetings all over Los Angeles, progressives and Democrats. Initially we were yelling at one another, a lot of shouting, a lot of accusations, and then there was a certain degree of collaboration. And that collaboration was the basis for Truth Out, which we described at the time as a blue-green coalition. And it took off. We were able, I think, to unite some important components of the left, I thought.
So you had union support, you had environmental support. How many people did you have coming to the website at your peak?
At the height of what we were doing, we had about 300,000 a day.
A day, every day.
Correct.
And when people come to a website like Truth Out or Reader Supported News, and there's a number of articles that are posted, do you get a sense of how many people actually read the articles?
Well, it's a little difficult to tell. I mean, we can tell the number of people that view the article. And we can tell how often an article is viewed. Oh, I assume that you assume that it is read. Some people just kind of, you know, scan through it. But yeah, sure, we know what the readership is like. We can certainly easily tell that. We don't track our readers individually. We don't want to know who you are or what you read. But we can tell how many times an article has been viewed, certainly, yes.
Okay. And the Truth Out, of course, is still going. You're not affiliated with the current incarnation of Truth Out?
Not at this time.
Okay. So how long were you with Truth Out, and then what prompted you to segue over to Reader Supported News?
I was there until from 2001, beginning of 2001. Truth Out, I originally started with the assistance of my cat. That was it. It was me and Kitty starting Truth Out. By 2009, we had 33 employees. There were some organizational difficulties that I'm not at liberty to get into. I apologize.
That's okay. Well, how were you supported? Where did you get the funding to have 33 employees?
We were raising close to $2 million a year.
I assume you're a nonprofit.
We were.
And so you're getting foundation money?
Some.
Uh-huh. You never sold advertising.
We did not. And we're not getting any foundation money now, by the way. We're 100% supported.
But Truth Out is still going. I assume that they still get Reader Support. They still get foundation money. Is that correct?
I can't speak to that. I believe that may be the case, but I can't confirm or deny it.
Well, one of the reasons I'm interested in this is because even with PRN, we're talking about institutions on the internet that are sustaining a progressive point of view that will not be tolerated by the corporate media. You know, people talk about the mainstream media. I think we're the mainstream media, and CNN and NBC, all these other things, they're the corporate media.
They have one critical thing that we do not have, and that is an FCC broadcasting license. With that, you can reach a number of people because they have direct access to the most powerful propaganda tool of propaganda ever invented. It's called a television. I know people personally who it's not true, and it doesn't matter until it's on TV. And that's the way they look at things. And that's really how you define the center of American politics, by those people. And those people go to the polls in some numbers. And unless you can get some of those people who live and die by what's on their television to kind of open up their minds a little bit, you're not getting any traction.
And so you are now running another website, Reader Supported News.
Correct.
And how many people come to Reader Supported News on a daily basis?
We're rsn.org, just so you know. We don't get the kind of traffic we used to get. There's a lot more competition and a lot of sites out there that are buying competition. We're a little bit closer to about 30,000 a day.
And do you get any sense that the people who come to your site read the articles?
When you say read, you mean thoroughly consider the article?
Well, you tell me what kind of interaction.
I don't know. I would have to be sitting next to them discussing it with them as they read. So it's really a little difficult to tell. But I think from the comments section, to really understand what our readers are thinking and what they're gleaning from the articles, read the comments, because that really is a great gauge of who's reading and what they think. When I write an article, I know people go through my article and they actually pull out quotes from throughout the entire article, and they actually quote what I'm saying, and they either tell me that I'm a complete blithering idiot or that I'm a genius or somewhere in between. Or they segue off of what I said to add additional comments of their own.
Yeah, the comment sections on the internet are on these websites are quite amazing, actually.
You get very, very good people in there, actually, from time to time. We really like our commenters.
Yeah. And they do vary from website to website. I noticed a great difference, for example, in the comments from Daily Coast than from Reader Supported News. I mean, it's a whole other incredibly snide in some websites. And although I have to say, my articles on the internet are on the environment. Are also at ecowatch.com, which you would expect to be pretty pro-green. And I think there must be people who are paid to sit and make nasty comments about, especially about articles about nuclear power and global warming. Look,
if you're not pissing off the knuckle draggers, then you're not accomplishing anything.
All right.
That's my first clue that I'm actually doing good work. I wrote an article a few years back drawing a connection between Republican political banter and the attack in Tucson, Arizona that gravely injured Representative Gabrielle Giffords, and killed several of the people, including a couple of prominent local politicians. And I drew a corollary between the two, the rhetoric, the GOP Republican rhetoric, and the event. And someone promptly wrote an article on a blog titled, "Mark Ash is a Moron." And if you Google that, you get the article. I loved it. I felt like I had really accomplished something because I was speaking to, I don't have to explain this to most of my readers, to our readers on our website. They know this already. But unless you can get through the thick skulls of the Fox News crowd, you're not gaining any traction.
Yeah. So how many employees does Reader Supported News have now?
We're currently at a dozen with another four or five regular paid contributing authors.
And what do employees do at a website like Truth Out or Reader Supported News? Do they just
those newsletters that we send out have to be compiled. We have to go through the material. We have to figure out what's in, what's out. We have to get it prepared for mailing. Get it up on the website. We have to have donor support. We have to have a guy who's a technician who can troubleshoot problems technically. So there's a lot to be done. There's administration. I mean, just the back end of any business. You have to have administration. You have to have somebody who can actually cash the checks and contact the tax preparer. You know, all this stuff that nobody thinks of.
And do you have an office or is it all virtual?
It's all virtual.
So none of the employees of Reader Supported News are in the same room doing the work. They're all at their own PCs or wherever in their own
homes.
Or
normally they are not.
Do you have an actual office?
I do not. I work out of my home. I'm talking to you from my home office.
Okay, very good. And where are you, in L.A.?
No. The 213 is a former Los Angeles number, and I was certainly there at that time. I live now in northern Sonoma County near a town called Sebastopol, which is near the Russian River.
Right. No, I know where that is. And you're surrounded by marijuana.
Country.
You're surrounded by marijuana plants, right?
We are surrounded by marijuana plants and damn good ones, too.
Very good. Well, that, we're talking with Mark Ash, the founder of two of the biggest of the progressive websites, First Truth Out and now Reader Supported News. And do you think that the readership of progressive websites is growing or stable? What's your sense of the business?
Well, absolutely, I believe, and I believe that we're having an absolutely verifiable impact on the mainstream media. We force their hand every day, and it's not just reader-supported news. There are a lot of good publications out there. One of the big differences between now and 15 years ago is that now there are a lot more progressive publications online, a lot more voices. There's a movement. There had always been a progressive movement because the progressive movement's dated back literally to the Civil War and before. There's an online publishing movement that it really kind of is dedicated to disseminating the message and keeping the internet free, which is very, very important to the entire process. When it comes to net neutrality is a big deal. And I fear that the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is going to step in on behalf of the larger ISPs and try to rescind that action taken by Tom Wheeler at the FCC in an attempt to put, net neutrality back in on the defense. Who knows
well,
where we'll go?
Victory. When you,
well,
when
it, it, know, it is a huge victory, but it's not necessarily binding if the court can strike it down.
Wow. I didn't know this was in front of the court now.
And it's right back in front, and it's the D.C. Circuit Court, which is basically, you know, a subsidiary of Robert Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy, LLC.
Yeah.
You know?
And the Alito. Mark,
yeah,
publisher of the Reader Supported News, tell people how to get to your website.
rsn.org.
And you get contributions, I guess, in the mail, and I assume you have a portal. And we're all
we do.
Mark, hey, great to talk with you, Mark. We'll talk again. Take care.
Okay, sir. Take care, Harvey. Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.